massive gravity. And I have a lot of things to play with. If I want to be as conservative as possible, just do the easiest thing. The easiest thing would be, well, I have one dynamical metric, G. I want that to be F or W. It ought to be. I have one reference metric, the F. The easiest thing, the first thing that comes to mind is take it to be Minkowski. If you do that, there are no solutions. And then from there, since we insist on doing massive gravity or bigravity, then we ought to find a way out. And that's the way out I want to find. But I mean, that's one part of the talk, and then there's another part. But OK, so hello. And this is based on work with Claudio De Rama and Andrew Tolley, and it's already on the archive. So if you really like it, you can look it up. So why are we doing this? Well, people do massive gravity because they think it's a mechanism, might be a mechanism for cosmic acceleration. Which massive gravity are we talking about? Well, it's the IGT. Why are we doing this specific type of massive gravity? Because it's cost-free, in the sense that it propagates 5 degrees of freedom, not 6. And very importantly, which type of cosmological solutions are we after here? F or W. Why? Simplicity. There is no other strong reason that tells that they ought to be F or W. They can be F or W look-alike, but not exactly F or W. It's just us being picky here. There are other ways. What do we ask of these solutions? And this is important for the following. We want these solutions to be stable and compatible with observations. And we will define, like in the next slide, what we mean by stable and compatible with observations. So stability bound. Take your theory, write the Hamiltonian of your theory. It's going to look like this. If you're very simple, like a 1 degree of freedom, if you want your theory to be unitary, you want alpha to be more than 0. Now, depending on how complicated your theory is, alpha might be a function of a lot of parameters in your theory. And so you will find regions of the parameter space where the theory is stable, maybe where it isn't. You have to see how it propagates. But if everything is simple, alpha is more than 0, your theory is unitary. And we would say something about the gradient and attack and instability later. But that's what we're after, I guess, in most slides here. So if you're doing massive gravity, in the simplest possible scenario, we just know that, for example, in the linear theory, and you consider the unitary spin representation of the Zeta group, then you're going to have a massless representation, partially massless, and a massive representation, unitary representation of the Zeta group. If you have that, you have that only when this is true. So you have this sort of theorem that tells you that if you're doing massive gravity, at least at the linearized level, there is this relation. So as soon as you are here, in terms of the value of your mass, then your theory might well be unitary. But this is, again, this sort of theorem is there for the Sitter and linearized massive theory. This is not what we're doing, but just to give you a picture of what's going on. Just remember that m squared more than 2h squared, it's unitarity. That's one thing. Now, of course, if you're doing observation, I mean, if you write down the Friedmann equation for our theory, it's bound to have the usual pieces. I'm not writing matter here, but it's bound to have a lot of pieces here, lambda. But there ought to be a piece proportional to m squared, because we are doing massive gravity here. Now, of course, we know that before dark energy sets in, the GR is an extremely good description of what's going on. So we want for a long time this term to be subleading, very subleading, with respect to what we have here, maybe here, certainly here, et cetera. So if we combine, and this is a very simplistic picture, but I'll make it more precise, just to give you an idea, if we combine these two conditions, then we want stability, was telling us that m squared ought to be larger than h squared or 2h squared. And then this bound is telling us that m squared ought to be smaller than h squared. So there is this sort of contradiction. See, there's this tension between these two effects, stability versus observation. OK, everything I told you was very simple. Linearized massive gravity gave us that m squared more than 2h squared. The other bit was in the Friedmann equation. But everything was simple. It was Fierce-Pauli. Now we have a fully nonlinear theory of massive gravity. And well, this linear theory is very specific, but there's the Einstein-Hilbert piece. This un have a very specific form here, as you can see. You can write everything as determinants. It's basically characteristic polynomial they're made of. And there is this very specific structure. So x here, u is a function of x, and x is this one. So remember when I told you that G and F play a very specific role, and of course, they come out in a very specific form. That form is determined by that determinant of 1 plus lambda x, but everywhere you see the square root of g minus 1 f. So I would say the signature of this, or one of the signatures of this massive gravity theory, which has no ghost, it's that square root of g minus 1 f, square root of gf. Okay, so this is going to be with us all the time here. So, okay, why do we like it? Okay, I told you already there's no ghost, then the Weierstrass works very well in this theory. The cutoff is high enough that you've got a linear, nonlinear, and quantum regime, so you can do calculation before you actually get very, before it gets very hard. And one thing I want not to confuse you is the following. Here you see these coefficients, n, and they go from 0 to 4, but I ought to tell immediately, just for the sake of what I'm going to say later, that this BN notation is very convenient. But if you ask yourself, what are the free parameters in massive gravity, at least in this massive gravity, there's just two of them, alpha 3 and alpha 4. And I'll define them later, but there are just two free parameters. So you might think already, and when I was handing you that stability condition, or that condition which was coming from the Friedmann equation, there were no free parameters there, right? I mean, Pierce-Pauli, there are no free parameters. Here, we have this nonlinear theory, we have alpha 3, and we have alpha 4. So maybe those two, they can help us to satisfy both those bounds and, you know, and eliminate that conflict between stability and observation. So this theory is fine, and it also gives us some freedom, which might be useful, might not be useful at all. We will have to check. OK. Now, you're armed with that theory. We try and look for cosmological solution. And I was, as I was telling you in this paper, I think it's 2011, they proved that there are no FRW solution if F is Minkowski. Remember, F is here.
That's assuming you use some expanding or something. I mean, if it were equal to a constant, that would just be flat space.
Yeah, no. So we're assuming G to be FRW and F to be Minkowski.
And then what are the assumptions on A?
By A, well, sorry, what do you mean by A?
Well, if the scale factor were a constant, an FRW would just be applied FRW would just be flat space.
Oh, no, in that case you might have. Yeah, in that case you might have solutions.
So the same thing as what? Any other A? Any more?
Yeah, you can have H. I mean, if you're doing the sitter, then you might have, well, actually also in the sitter. Also in this, actually no, because if you are in the sitter, actually let me say, we've done that, actually. Even if you take, say, G to be the sitter, and even F to be either Minkowski or the sitter, there are solutions there, in principle. So if you only worry about the solution, there are solutions. But when you do perturbations around the solution, you're going to hit a ghost. And I will actually have a couple of slides about that. So even if you're not that picky, you will have problems. And the problems are not from the solution itself. The problems are from your doing perturbations around that solution. Now, the perturbations atop that solution are not stable. And we will see that, actually. Yes?
Going back to the first biometric gravity theory, Hayson-Rosen, the first case that is important, that theory violates the binary pulsar data.
The bimetric theory.
Yes. It's a theory where you have a Minkowski flat metric plus a sort of Riemannian metric, like what you're doing. And so it produces a monopole and a dipole radiation that violates, that disagrees with the
okay, so, pulsar. But.
What's the story on this?
Well, I think the difference is that this biometric theory is highly non-generic, and this structure here, there are plenty of biometric theories, and in fact, so, I mean, you must be aware that you take massive gravity, linearize, Pierce-Pauli, and then you try and do a nonlinear theory, and this has been tried by many people. I think Deser is one of them, for example, and I mean, there was a theorem up, there was almost a no-go theorem up to 2010, which said, well, just don't try to write a nonlinear theory of massive gravity, because if you do, you will end up exciting a 6 degree of freedom, which is a ghost. And I mean, that is true. Most completions are not, I mean, they have a ghost. But because of this specific structure here, of these UNs, of this potential for massive gravity, if you will, then in that case, you discover that there are no ghosts. And it's this specific structure as well, which when you're trying to study the Weinstein of this theory, when you're trying to study, basically most of the times when you're doing the Weinstein, either massive gravity, I don't think there are studies for, I don't know about back gravity, but when you're doing massive gravity, the fifth force, or if you want, the helicity zero mode is extremely windscreen in this specific massive gravity. So I think that whenever we are trying to extrapolate whatever we know about generic nonlinear theories of massive gravity, we ought to be very careful because these are, at least in terms of degrees of freedom, these are shown, this massive gravity has shown already to be very special. So whatever we want to extrapolate from other theories might not be the case here.
So in fact,
there are a couple of papers that I'm aware of. I think the one I know more is this paper by. So I think it's it's Claudia, but then there is Andrew Mathis, and then Tolley, and they have this. Actually, they have exactly binary pulsars. They study exactly those. I mean, they're doing it with Galilean theories, which is basically what's going to come out of the decoupling limit. And so the DCT zero mod is basically a Galilean eventually, but they've been able. Of course, you get all the Galilean interactions there, so you get a cubic, a quartic, and a quintic. And I think it has been shown, and it's not so for the cubic, it has been shown that there is no problem. So this problem you're referring to. So for the primary pulsar, as long as you have this cubic interaction, this cubic Galilean, you're not going to observe anything as opposed to what you would see in general relativity. Now, they tell me, because the quartic Galilean is very, very hard to handle, and they've not done that yet. But with partly using some of the results we have here, you might have a way to study those. But that has not been done. So cubic is fine, quartic not so much, because people are not able to do it yet. Something. Okay, I lost it. Sorry. Okay, so now for W solutions, if F is Minkowski, different ways around it. What about using inhomogeneities in F? Sure, you can do that. We'll see that later. You can allow for F to be different. So different solutions for F exist. For example, F can be the sitter, F can be FRW. And in this context, we actually tried F the sitter, G the sitter, which was asked before, and we'll see why that doesn't work. But what we did with Andrew was like, okay, get this ghost-free theory, add some matter content, just to be more generic, and assume that F is now FRW. So F is FRW, G is FRW, matter content, let's try to be as generic as possible. Remember, we have that freedom in alpha 3 and alpha 4. Can we please satisfy the stability bound and be happy with the Friedman equation bound as well? But before we do that, just to give you what's going on in this field, I would say that if you're playing with inhomogeneities, which is what these guys did back in 2011, I mean, there's lots of things which you might worry about, but you shouldn't, or at least in this paper they show that you shouldn't just read your favorite sentence here. I would say, for example, that even if the metric is perfectly homogeneous and isotropic, the inhomogeneities can show up in cosmological perturbations, but they can easily be small, and whatever you might worry about here, they've sort of taken care of it at the level of the background, but if you're doing perturbations, you don't know if everything is working yet. And a lot of people are working on this. It's just one direction people are taking. You don't need to take it, but it's one way. Okay, then you can modify your assumption to allow for FRW if you really want FRW. Some people have looked at open universe solution in, I would say, recently in 2013, 2012, but that's unstable. It's not. If you do the perturbations around it, it has been proven to be unstable. You can make the reference metric the sitter. That's what we did with Andrew, but that is also unstable. We will see that. You can make the reference metric dynamical. So you're doing bigravity here. A lot of people working on it, That's also what we did and what we're going to talk about here. And of course, just to give you another idea of what's going on, some people have decided to just make a huge, significant modifications of the theory, so new degrees of freedom, basically. If you add new degrees of freedom, you might end up finding a FW solution, nice solution. So there's this quasi-tilladum thing, which came out, I guess, from people at NYU, which had a ghost, but now in the new version doesn't have a ghost. You can do Lorentz-Valetti massive gravity, very mass, you know, all this extended massive gravity, non-local massive gravity. Just to tell you that the direction that we are pursuing here, it's one of many. We like it more, it's the best, we think, but you know, there's plenty of other things that you can do. Okay, now, we're doing nonlinear, we have nonlinear massive gravity, so we have the full theory of massive gravity. Remember before I was talking to you about that alpha being more than zero, that gives us unitarity. If you have more degrees of freedom, it's basically the same thing, you just read off, this would be the coefficient, but now it's a metric, so you want that matrix to be positive definite in order for your theory to be unitary. If you care about this, Iguchi, of course, was the first guy to do it, and then there's some modifications around it by Deser, by Sorbo, Risa, Waldron, etc. Quick example, how do we get this alpha more than zero to work? Because in the De Sitter linearized case, we basically have a theorem that was helping us. Now we don't, or in the general case, we don't. So how does it work? It's very simple. I'm just taking an example from this paper just to show you what goes on. You take the action, you write it down. This is basically Fierce-Pauli if F is G bar. Tensor decomposition, you use the IDM formulas, you solve the constraint equation, and you do a couple of canonical transformations. So you start with this theory, do a couple of things which you're very familiar with, you end up with this theory, which is exactly in the form that they wanted it to be before. It's exactly in this form. Okay, so let's go read the coefficient for p squared. The coefficient for p squared is positive other than this new squared term. But this new squared term, for this to be more than zero, you end up in the Iguchi bound, which again is m squared more than 2h squared. But now, this was very simple for this very simple theory, but I refuse to show you what we did with the full nonlinear DRGT massive gravity because it's very complicated, matrices, etc. I mean, it's not very complicated conceptually, but it's boring, basically. So I refuse to show it to you, but I give you the result. So remember, the simple result is here. A slight modification of the simple result is here. So as promised, we have some m squared more than 2h squared piece. We ought to have the alpha 3 and alpha 4, the free coefficients in massive gravity here. So this is some sort of easy generalization of the Iguchi bound. M tilde squared more than 2h squared. This is a polynomial in H over HF. HF is the Hubble of the F metric. Okay, it is independent of the precise form of matter, and we have an interpretation of it. So, I mean, there is the form of matter in there only through the dependence by Hubble, and we have an idea on why it is. It's basically because the theory is ghost-free. But, of course, on the Friedmann side, we want this bit, which is similar but different, to be much smaller than 2h squared or smaller than 2h squared. You combine these two requirements, stability and observation, you end up with two polynomials of the same degree, the ratio between them, and you want it to be much, much larger than one. That's what we wanted, to have an FRW solution in massive gravity. Now, as you might be very happy at the beginning, alpha 3 and alpha 4 are free, I can do whatever I want. You cannot. It's very hard to satisfy this condition. Even using alpha 3 and alpha 4, you know, alpha 3 minus alpha 4, all that sort of playing out. And if you consider that H, of course, varies across the cosmological epochs, and you try and satisfy this condition, you don't.
Sorry, I think I just got a little lost. So this is under what assumptions you're working with?
This yes.
Background metric, and if so, which one?
FRW background metric, FRW dynamical metric. And if you work with Minkowski reference metric F, no solution. If you work with this, you're happy at the beginning because you find a solution. You even find a bound which you might be able to satisfy, but you compare the two things, you're not. And that said, yes, exactly. Yes, H is F to G. I should, yeah, but I never know if I should write it H or H to G, but yes, that's what it is. Okay, so what do you do from that point? Now, from that point, we decided to do bigravity, which is one of the ways out. So what do we mean by gravity? Of course, you just take GR, the massive gravity bit, Einstein-Hilbert piece for F. Now, I must underline here, which is important for the next bit of the talk, which is quite different, goes in a quite different direction, it's the following. It's very important. For now, I mean, we're coming from massive gravity. So the mindset is, OK, G is the real metric. At least my mindset is like, G is the real guy. F is just there because you need a tensor to contract G with. And so it's just there, but it's a reference metric. So now it's dynamical. And it's just as important. It does have the same dignity. F and G are basically just as important. In fact, you can tell this by realizing that just exchanging G and F, the M Planck and MF, beta n, which are these coefficients, and beta 4 minus n, and the theory is the same theory. So F and G, assuming that MP and MF are the same, for example, are really on the same footing here. Now, we're coming from massive gravity, so we don't think that's true, but it is true in the following. So if you're doing back gravity, you shouldn't ask yourself that one metric is more important than the other. It's not true. They are on the same footing. Oh, we would see that. But for now, since I want this to be true, I'm not writing matter here. I'm just trying to be vague about matter. But I will write matter when I'm after cosmological solution, yes.
So are we going to have any Maxwell's gravitons or no?
Well, so when you're doing by gravity, you have a spin 2 massive particle and spin 2 massive particle and a spin 0 massless particle, right? But then you ask yourself, between F and G, who is dominating the massive eigenstates of your theory? Now, in principle, just by looking at the Lagrangian, you cannot say that. You have to go and perturb around the solution and check who's dominating the massive eigenstates. And we will see that. But in terms of the degrees of freedom, sure, you have seven of them, a massive theory and a massless theory. And you can see that because we are adding a Einstein-Hilbert piece next to massive gravity.
Maybe I'll ask again.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
If you have two metrics, and you can have two different Minkowski light cones.
Oh, we will get into that. Yes. Yes, in principle, yes.
They won't be together. They may not.
We'll talk about that, yes. But talking about the stability bound for a second here, so we have the stability bound in bigravity. How does it look like? It looks like exactly like the massive gravity one, except for this factor here. OK, so if you're after this stability bound and you know about the Friedmann, which is going to push you in the different direction, smaller or equal to here, you know that in order to have something really different, qualitatively different than what we had before, you better have that this guy, this ratio here, is very large. Otherwise, you go back exactly to the same conflict that you had before, and now your work has basically been useless. Now, the other thing I want to say very quickly is that the massive gravity bound, which we derived with Andrew, was exact, just exact. Now, doing this exactly is a bit hard. So we derived it in many different ways. So in the mini superspace, basically in the 0 plus 1 action, basically because we're after the unitary bit, so the p squared bit, and so you don't really need to worry about anything else. We also have done it in the coupling limit of bigravity, which is a completely independent check. And the partially master gives us some interesting non-trivial checks. And also this bound, it doesn't look symmetric now, but that bound better be symmetric under this, right? Because it's coming from a symmetric theory under that identification. So this bound better be symmetric under that. And it is. And I'll show you that it is. And of course, we recover massive gravity when MF goes to infinity. Right? We recover the massive gravity bound there. So it makes perfect sense. But as I was stressing, the whole point here is that we want to be where this guy is huge. Otherwise, all the work has been wasted. And let's go there and see what happens. So again, what was not possible before is the following, that ratio being very large. Let's just write down the Friedmann equation for both of them. Now we've got the h squared, the hf squared bit. From the Friedmann equation side, the requirement is going to be identical as before. So by identical, I mean this identical structure, not identical numbers, but identical structure. So we've got something like this, which ought to be much smaller than h squared. But if we are in this region, there's a strong bound on M squared being much smaller than something, but if we are in this region, we don't need to put another strong bound on M squared to be smaller than something, because again, the bound can be satisfied by this guy, can be helped, I mean, M squared can be helped by that guy. And so in this region, let's go look for solutions and see if they satisfy the bound. Then if you look for a solution, you solve for M tilde squared, you solve for HF, you plug in into the bound, you plug in your solution into the bound, requiring that beta 1 is different from 0, beta 1 being this guy here. You can put the other guys, all of them, to 0, just to go quickly and see if the bound is satisfied. Plug in all the numbers, the bound is actually finally satisfied. It's got something like this, which is a trivial identity, which is telling you that if you are in that region, if you're in this region here, the bound in bigravity, the stability bound, is actually satisfied. So this stability versus observation conflict, which is there all the time in M4W, massive gravity, is actually resolved in bigravity. And we have an understanding of what's going on also dynamically. And actually, yes, before I say that, I promised you a bound which was symmetric. And in fact, that same bound which I was writing before as a 1 plus, just to underline the connection with massive gravity, if you write it down in the most beautiful form, you actually end up with this bound. And remember, under this exchange, this bound does not change at all. So the initial duality between G and F in the theory, it's preserved as it ought to be also in the final stability bound here. Now, OK, as we were saying before, G and F are really on the same footing. So they can both dominate, in principle, the mass eigenstates. Then you have to do a calculation to see what's going on. And we will see later in, I would say, 5 or 6 slides, that in order to know who's being massive, for example, you can go and check who is being screened, basically, the Galilean of which metric, either F or G, is being screened. And if you go in this region, Yes, it's true. I mean, because in order to see, I mean, we want a specific example to see if the stability bound is satisfied. And you can choose, of course, if you want to couple your matter to F and G, but we choose to do so with G. And I guess with F, we found out that you can actually couple to it a cosmological constant, and the bound would still be satisfied, but you cannot get much more playful. I mean, we haven't tried to get super playful with what you can do on F at the same time. We just wanted a proof of principle that you can satisfy the stability bound in bigravity, and we put some generic matter on the F side, and basically no matter or cosmological concept on it.
It's not yet, doesn't matter
whether two has the particle or which one has a massive. Oh, so if you go in this regime here, which is the regime where the stability bound is actually satisfied, you will discover that it is the dual Galilean, which means, well, it's basically the Galilean corresponding to the F metric, which is being screened, which means that F is dominating the massive eigenstates of the theory. That's what you see. But I mean, this is just telling you, it's not showing you, but I will show you later. OK, so yes. And actually, this solution is not what we had, because in 2012 and 2013, Akrami, Koivisto, and Sanstad, they just play with some solution in massive gravity, but also in bigravity. And they did this analysis, which compares these various theories with lambda CDM. Now, we looked at their table, which, you know, it's not very completely clear what they do, but they have this very small table of various possible combinations of the coefficients of massive gravity. And they compare it, and they just study the chi-squared value and compare it with everything.
With what observations?
Oh, so I do not have complete control over what they're doing, but I can show. I have a slides because honestly, I do not control what they're doing, but I can tell you what they say they're doing. Yes. So this paper, they say that this is what they're doing, basically. And they do a statistical analysis around this fact. And that's what they say they have. I mean, it's extremely short paper, so it's hard to I guess there's a follow-up which is going to clear up what they have. But this is what they say that they're doing. And they can compare lambda CDM and a lot of solutions in massive gravity and bigravity, especially actually bigravity.
So why does massive gravity affect any of those
Just a second. That would be my guess. Yes, that would be my guess. I mean, not. Yeah,
what,
that would
what
be.
Is, like, what's the effect on the Hubble expansion? Like, can you draw me a graph of k is h of z, the right changes parameter, and like, this is what happens to it? I mean, I've just got no idea why you would have this constraint.
I can get into that in details later if you will. I mean, now I don't have a very short, very nice graph that I can show you that, but I mean, it's supposed to change slightly the expansion, but I mean, I would need to show you the details.
Is there any intuitive picture? Like, can this be mapped onto W, not WA? So there's some like picture in your head of what it looks like?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent. In this stuff, I mean, because I mean, it's everything boils down to the Galilean eventually when you're talking about observations. Yes. So they have this, and we actually were able to check that we by chance we basically we also have one of their solutions. But what we can do now, which they were not able to do before, is plug in numbers not in their background solution or perturbations. We can just right away write down the stability bound, plug in their numbers, and see.
Hold on, B0 here is the cosmological constant, right?
Yeah, but they're setting it to zero here.
Why do they set it to zero?
Oh, because, I mean, that's what we're doing. They're doing hundreds of things. They're not just setting it to zero. What I'm showing you is just two lines, but they have like 54 lines. So they're just trying to be as generic as possible and fit everything to what they have. What, since we have this, I mean, the easiest thing for us, since we have that stability bound, is to compare this. And we are setting to zero everything, beta 2, beta 3. We can just keep beta 1 alive here in what we had before. And you realize that this configuration here corresponds to this configuration here. And therefore, we can actually get to check that the bound in this solution is satisfied. We could check if the bound is satisfied. We plug in the numbers, and we get the idea is satisfied. So with our calculation, we're basically supporting, or we're providing them with a way that says, well, you have solutions. You think you have solutions in bigravity or massive gravity, especially in bigravity now. We have a stability bound. Go check before you end up doing all this crazy statistical analysis and compare with all this data which they think they have. Just check if the stability bound is satisfied first. And for some of these configurations, actually, which I've not shown you, the bound is not satisfied. So we can actually say that those are not interesting anymore because they are unstable. But some of them are, and this is for some of them that are, this is the example. Everything is positive. So the theory, that solution, that specific solution is actually stable as well. So the summary of conclusions of this part of the talk is the following, right? So there are no FLW solutions if you have Minkowski. There's a lot of things that you can do. Then if you want to play the FRW game in massive gravity, you might think that you can do it. It seems like you can. But when you consider everything, stability, and observations, you realize that you cannot. As soon as you're doing bigravity, everything is fine. And of course, what I was talking about is the stability of the scalar sector. But the vector sector is also fine. I'm not showing you, but it's actually easier to show that. And we also have an understanding of the dynamics and the self-accelerating solution. So we are happy about it.
Can I just ask, with that previous slide, I've read a couple of examples, and they couple both G and F to matter. Is this still the same argument?
No. So here, in order at least for us, we were coupling G to matter, like pretty generic. And in order, as you saw from the Friedman equation, we were trying to be more careful on the F side. So on the F side, we're not. But don't be fooled, because on the F side, the HF square equation, you can put a cosmological constant in there.
It doesn't change the bounds.
No, it doesn't change the bounds. But you cannot put just generic. You can put just whatever you want. I mean, if you can put whatever you want in principle, but then you have to go check the bound. Now, we found out ourselves a very easy configuration to check, and so we checked it. OK, so this is, I told you already. Yeah.
The symmetric stability bound you showed, was that independent of the matter content, or was that for scalar field coupled to G?
No. That is before considering putting the matter in. But I've been stressing this. But So
in particular, before deciding whether it's supposed to be or not.
Yes, but the nice thing is that although you would expect, in fact, so I don't know if you are familiar with so there's a paper, for example, by Grisa and Sorbo on this sort of thing, and when they had first bound in mind, but I mean in general, when you have this bound, for example, you want an M squared piece, and then here there's a lot of things that can happen, right? So in principle, you would expect some, I don't know, H squared, of course, but maybe you want some H dot, and you want some other things which are even more specific of the matter content that you have. And the way we have derived the stability bound says that, and when we derive this, I mean, there's two things here. One is the cosmological solution in black gravity that these guys, Akrami, Koivisto, and Stansons, are after. So for that, you have to choose a very specific, I mean, we chose a very specific matter content so that we could go and check quickly if the bound is satisfied. But the bound we have derived is true for all matter. And the key point is, just as it is in massive gravity, so this is not a feature or a strange thing in black gravity, it's also there in massive gravity, that the matter content in this stability bound, the way it enters, it's extremely simple. It's actually just through H squared. So there is a matter content. Of course, everything is going to depend on the matter content, but only implicitly, only through H squared. And we have, I mean, I can show you later, but we think that one of the reasons that, for example, H dot is not there, it's basically because if you have the Galilean in mind, the H dot will give you a ghost. And since we're coming from a ghost-free theory, this guy cannot be there. And in fact, in the Sorbo paper, this guy is there. But we know that actually that's one of the main differences with respect to what we have. But if you were paying attention at the beginning, I'm talking about stability, everything is fine, everybody's happy, but of course, let's not forget. But two things. The first is that there are perturbations in black gravity solutions. These guys also did it. And from the way it was formulated, we thought we had something different. So we looked into it. Actually, it's a matter of variables. So everything is fine. We agree. But remember that at the beginning, I had that alpha p squared. Then there was a beta q squared and a gamma grad q squared. And I was giving you the example of a generic Hamiltonian. What we talked about so far is just alpha. So alpha is more than zero. Everything is happy. And everybody's happy in black gravity. We ought to check that there is no gradient instability, right? I mean, I would say the first matter you check when you're doing something is unitarity, alpha. But how about beta? We haven't checked that yet. So there is. Sorry.
What happens to all these stability Hamiltonian equations?
When H is much larger, you're fine. I think we checked that actually. I mean, there ought to be no problem.
But wasn't the fact that the mass had to be greater than 2H squared, so the mass has to change with time?
Oh, but no. So M squared more than 2H squared in fierce pi, right? Now you're in a quite different condition, because you've got that H over HF. Sorry, HF for MF plus H Planck over M Planck. So now that guy is playing the role of much larger than 2A squared. So that is actually in contradistinction with what you normally have as the M squared more than 2A squared. The key point is that we're not putting a lot of pressure on M squared larger than something anymore.
So if it's allowed to have, if it's stable during inflation when you can have quasi-discretion expansion with really large value of H, it's stable now and you can have quasi-discretion expansion with a really small value of H, then it's got nothing to do with the cosmological constant problem, because it can support quasi-discretion expansion with any value of H you want.
But I mean, in playing with this theory, you're capturing a lot of things. So it also depends on what you're doing with alpha 3, what you're doing with alpha 4. And the solutions that, I mean, everything I've shown you, for example, the solution I've shown you was an extremely specific solution just to show you that the bound is satisfied. But if you're trying to say what sort of equation of state these theories have, is it omega minus 1 and stuff like that, well, you also have to pay with beta 0, beta 1, beta 2, and beta 3, which we're not doing here just to show you that the stability bound is satisfied.
But in principle, it works with any value of H. With any value of H, not so.
No, I mean,
so it doesn't say anything about cosmology.
No, it's not like in principle it works. You have to check every single solution of yours and see if it works.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, in order to show you that it is possible to satisfy the stability bound, I've chosen a very specific solution, a very specific beta 1 non zero, everybody else is zero. I'm not showing you everything. And in fact, this, what, I mean, this relates one to one with that huge table of which I showed you just two lines. You have to check, I mean, you have to consider that the full space of solution is a huge table. It's not just one thing. And that one thing has been useful for me to show that you can satisfy it in one specific configuration. But it's not, I mean, it's not the whole thing. If I was to show the whole table, it would be two slides. But I
think
But there's still, in
massive gravity itself, there's no great reason so far why the cosmological constant is zero. That's true.
So it addresses the new cosmological constant problem, not the old one.
I don't think anyone's saying it fully. Addresses it. I'm just saying that the hope for solution is that the acceleration is due in this case too.
Yeah. I mean, you need to go further than that.
You're not claiming that you self-accelerate during inflation, this inflation is still some other scale of field.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not claiming that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes?
It seems that if you want to satisfy stability, observational data, and so on, you have to choose a very specific solution.
Oh, no.
Cosmology.
So, I mean, and by very specific, you mean I've chosen that beta 1 to be non-zero and everybody else to be zero.
You have a specific solution in mind. Doesn't that smell of fine-tuning? Fine-tuning the universe.
Yes. So.
Very much so.
But wait, so, I mean, by this, I'm not saying that the only way to satisfy the stability bound is by choosing that beta 1 to be non-zero and everybody else to be zero. And, I mean, this is like a zero measure set of solutions in this stability bound. I mean, for example, if you choose to switch on actually that beta 1 coefficient, since we are in this H over M Planck region, so since we are in this region where the stability bound is satisfied, as soon as I switch on beta 1 is actually going to be the dominating term because it is the one with the highest power of HF over H. So it's not all the solutions, but it's pretty generic. In this specific region, saying that beta 1 is non-zero and all the others are zero, or saying that beta 1 is non-zero and all the others are also non-zero in that specific solution is not a big difference because beta 1 is going to dominate anyway the solutions because it's the one that multiplies the highest power of HF over H. So it looks completely non-generic. It looks completely non-generic because I wanted to give you the cleanest possible path to satisfying the stability bound. But the only thing you actually need to say for that stability bound to be satisfied is you switch on beta 1 and you say that it's the same order of beta 2 and beta 3. You can actually still satisfy that bound. Of course, it's not going to look that nice as this one does, that simple, but you can still do it. So it's not as non-generic as it seems to be.
The universe has been evolving a long time.
Yeah.
So why would it stick to this particular solution? See what I'm saying? It seems so.
I mean,
something will happen.
No, but
so. What you're doing in the
So I mean, but so the theory is not. I mean, it's not. What I'm saying is that so the theory is not that the space of parameter of the theory is not that large, right? We eventually have this alpha 3 and alpha 4, and by going in this region and requiring that beta 1 is switched on just as much as everybody else, we're not really doing a strong tuning. We're just asking those betas to be of the same order. We have two parameters. This basically corresponds to saying that the two parameters are more or less of the same order. It's not a huge tuning. It's not. I mean, at least I think.
If I turn beta 1 on and beta 2 and beta 3 to 0, which go level do I get in a minute?
So I would have to check. I think the cubic, but I would have to check. Don't take this as a correct answer. I would have to check. OK, so as I said, we've done the alpha here. All this stability bound talk was about alpha. You want to check the so-called gradient instability. But other than that, wherever we overlap with what somebody else also has done, we agree. OK, so this, I don't think I really need to comment. So we started with FRW and FRW in the RGT. We find it exactly, but it was not viable. Now we are doing FRW and FRW by gravity stability, and everything works out. The bound is the one that you see at the bottom, and it's symmetric, so we're happy. So now we're going to talk about something completely different. And I just wanted to talk about both these things because they are very connected, at least in the way they were derived. But let me just say that this, and I have no idea what time it is, so how much do I have? Ten minutes. OK, so I'll be very quick. So basically, I told you that the stability bounding by gravity was not derived exactly. It was derived in many different ways, independent ways. So there is no one way. One works and the other doesn't. I mean, they're completely independent. I'm just listing them. One such way is to do the decoupling limit of by gravity and go check what happens there. So what do we mean by the decoupling limit of by gravity? I have to skip some slides. Maybe I'm skipping too many slides. I won't skip them. I'll just try to be quick. OK. So one way to do calculations in gravity in general, not just in massive gravity, is with the metric here. But you can also start introducing, you can basically use I think it's called the Einstein-Cartan formalism. While instead of playing with the metric G, we're playing with the Firbein E here. So the G metric has the Firbein E, the F metric has the Firbein F. This is purely by gravity now, so G and F are really on the same footing. There is this formalism, which is useful for many reasons, and I just go fast here. Now, massive gravity breaks some of the symmetry of the massless theory, and if you are in the Einstein-Cartan formalism, you don't just break the four diffs, you also break six local Lorentz transformations. One way to study massive gravity, one very useful trick, is the so-called Stukeberg trick, in which you actually put back this symmetry, the symmetries, to get a better understanding of the theory. If you put them back, you're going to put them back. You have to put them back the Lorentz, the LLTs, basically the local Lorentz transformations, but also the diffs. So this is the Stukeberg for the diffs. This is the Stukeberg for the Lorentz. I'll just be very quick here. So we're just doing by gravity in another way, using the Firbeins. And we're also using the Stukeberg trick. In massive gravity, by putting the massive term, you break the diffs like this. In by gravity, you break them in this way, and likewise for the local Lorentz transformations. But the main point is following. When we are doing by gravity, if you've done it before, I mean, you will realize that you have two dynamical metrics. You can put the Stukebergs. You generally put them on this side, on the side of the F metric. You see phi here, which is the phi which is going to give you the Galilean for people who have heard about the Galilean before. Basically, from here, from sticking in the Stukeberg on the F side, you're going to get what we normally call the Galilean field here. And we will see it when we go into the decoupling limit. But you can do things in a different way. And this is the point of this Galilean duality, which we are studying. But anyway, when we go into the decoupling limit by gravity, we're just going after a very specific statement, which is the following. So you have to check that everything we were talking about is in this limit here, with lambda free being the usual scale. You just take the decoupling limit in the usual way, you end up with S by gravity being the elasticity 2, 0, the free part, the elasticity 1, 0. this is the usual expansion, and this is the Galilean here. And you do that, and you end up with the elasticity. The part of the action which is described in the elasticity to elasticity zero interaction, which looks like this. So you've got two massless spin two here. The usual Galilean part, which is this one, h mu nu x mu nu. By x mu nu, it's the usual part. You just forget the betas, which are our free parameters. The epsilon structure, just, you know, just tensors. But here's the pi, which is here. So you basically get the Galilean as usual. And there is this other bit, which is quite unusual, though, because, OK, identify MPMF for a second. You've got lambda free or 2, so same thing for the metric G and for the metric F, V, and this other bit. And just to show you what I'm talking about, I hope I'm not going too fast. Remember that we have this expansion for the Firbine from G and this expansion for the Firbine for F, with the usual MF and MP at the bottom as it should be. So we've got this bit, and normally we expect two massless spin two. Normally, it's, of course, if you're doing massive gravity, it's one massless spin two and a Galilean. Now, the Galilean is here, but there's this other bit which is not there if you're doing massive gravity. Now, this other bit, of course, we want it to look simple. We want to isolate and see what these Galileans are doing. Simple behavior on this side, quite non-trivial behavior on this side, because why? It's this one. It does look pretty much like X, see? But it's V, which again, it's the companion of the h mu nu. Remember, once again, the difference between what is h doing here and what is v doing here. Now, v is highly non-trivial because this means not that it is multiplied by this Galilean-looking term. It is actually calculated at that point. So if you want these two interactions to look the same, if you want to sort of make sense of these Galileans that you see. I mean, you see there are going to be Galileans here, right? This is the normal one. This is this non-trivial one, but it's there. You want to extract that Galilean from that structure. What do you do? Well, you just do a coordinate transformation. You write the action down the usual way, plus there's a change of variable here. Just say the 4x tilde, v of x tilde, and y tilde. So how now the v mu term has the same structure of the h mu nu term as it should. But the price you pay is, if you go read the y tilde here as this structure, which again looks like the x structure before. But the price you're paying here, you're introducing this function zeta, which is defined implicitly. So zeta of the defining variable that we had before, remember in the previous slide, is defined this way. It's actually xa. So we have this function zeta, which is defined implicitly. And if you go dig into the way that zeta is defined, and remember the way phi was defined before, phi being the Stuckeberg that we have put into the metric at some point, so phi is this guy. So the way zeta is realized is that zeta is actually phi minus 1. Zeta is the inverse map of phi. I hope I'm not going, am I going too fast? A bit too fast, I guess, but I want to. Is anybody getting what I'm saying? Because I'm trying to go fast because I have 10 minutes, but if I'm going too fast. Okay, good, good, good. So remember, the important, there are two bits that you have to be careful here about. So the first thing was that we decided to put the Stuckeberg's into the F metric, and we have been stressing all over with that FG identification during this talk, that F and G are really, really on the same footing completely. So we have put in the Stuckeberg's on this side. We might, and if you do that, you end up with the Galilean here, as usual, into the coupling limit. But if we could have done just the same by sticking in the Stuckeberg's, not on this side, but on this side. It ought to be true, right? Because F and G are really on the same footing here. And if you do so, it ought to be true that you can express zeta in, of course, in a different variable now, but just in the same way. So zeta of x theta is basically x theta plus the other Galilean, the dual Galilean to the usual pi Galilean, but with exactly the same structure, just because of this F and G identification that we have. In fact, let me stress it again. We've got this. This is true. So we ought to be able to make this choice, or we ought to be able to make this other choice. It's the same thing, only pi and rho are again the Galilean. One is the Galilean seen from the G metric, and the other is the Galilean coming from the fact that you put these two cubers onto the, sorry, from one is coming from the fact that you put the stochobers on this side, and the other is coming from the fact that you put the stochobers on the other side. Then remember, you had phi before, now you have the inverse function of phi, zeta. So phi and zeta are talking to each other. One is the inverse map of the other. We ought to be able to do this because of this identification at the top. And wherever wherever you call pi the Galilean, you ought to call rho the dual Galilean. And everything is coming from this relation at the top. So what we found is that for every Galilean, there exists a dual Galilean. So for every pi, there exists a rho. And the way you can make pi talk to rho is by basically solving order by order this relation here. So you can express rho as a function of pi, the Galilean as a function of the dual Galilean, and vice versa. So you get this map. And if you invert the other way around, you get this map. So these two relations can be inverted. They look analogous. And they are both local. And this is important because you might think that, in principle, they could be non-local, right? Because you see this sort of box structure over here. But if you actually do the calculation and you try and invert it, you get a map which is local both ways. And this is very important. And just to give you I'll just try to wrap it up and give you an example. And because of, well, yeah, these two slides is all I want to tell you about. So now we know of this map, and let's try and make use of this map between pi and rho. Let's write down two Galilean theories, one for pi, one for rho, and we could have written them down, I guess, in a nicer form, but I want to write this L derivative Lagrangian here in this form, just because I know I'm going to vary the action. And so it's very convenient to have a pi here and a rho here. Now, we know that there is this relation between pi and rho, which is the following. This sort of duality toolbox between the two. This is the pi piece, which is, again, the usual box. This is the usual box for rho. And there is this relation between pi and rho because of the way zeta was defined, if you remember. And remember, this is an x, and this is an x tilde. So we have these two theories. We have this duality toolbox. What can we do with it? Take a generic Galilean. Okay? Take this generic Galilean theory. Vary the action. Vary the action, you get this. That's just very, very simple. Then use the duality toolbox. So express whatever you have in pi as a function of rho. So you have rho here. Remember, the sigma was defined in the previous slide. And we have this duality toolbox at the bottom. So you've got a Galilean theory, you're varying the action, you can express everything in terms of dual Galilean. Start with the dual Galilean, on the other hand. Start with something like this, and do the equations of motion for us. Vary the action for the dual Galilean. But as long as you have these identifications between the Pn coefficients and the Cn coefficients here, you're actually mapping the dual Galilean action into the Galilean action itself. So the pi, you're creating a non-trivial map between the rho action and the pi action with this map between the coefficients. So you're mapping Galileans into other Galileans. Now, of course, if you're mapping a quartic theory into a cubic theory, you might be happy with it. But this thing is much more striking when you're mapping a free theory with only C2 being different from zero, so very simple, nice free theory, into a theory which is much more ugly looking. I mean, it's much more non-trivial. So if you plug in that C2 being zero in that coefficient, in that relation before, you're going to have, so if you try and go from a free theory on this side, you will end up with a quintic theory on the other side. You've got here, you've got this, and here, you've got this. So we've got a duality within these two theories, which ought to be equivalent. But on the one side, you know, everything is like heaven because it's a free theory. S matrix, everything is trivial, and everything is causal. Everything is fine. But at least naively, at least at first sight, on this side, if I hadn't told you about this duality, what would have you done? And what do you do when somebody hands you a quintic Galilean theory? I don't know what you do, but you can find solutions. So for example, you will find eventually, if you consider the unsourced theory, just to keep everything simple, you'll find a plane wave solution. If you start studying the fluctuations around that solution, you will find out that some of them propagate with this speed. And as long as f double prime, which is this f, is smaller than zero, you will see that there are superluminal propagation in that theory on the right here. And there's nothing of the sort here. So what is that telling us? Well, I guess the easiest thing to say is the following. What's happening on this side is that the phase velocity and the group velocity are being more than one, which is allowed, because what's important is actually the front velocity. And the front velocity of this theory, it's something that you can calculate in the limit that k goes to infinite. And in that limit, of course, you cannot trust this calculation, because this calculation were done at tree level. You ought to consider everything, right? You have to consider loops and do the full calculation. So by uncovering this map, what we're saying is the following. Whenever you have a Galilean theory, you do all these sorts of calculations, which are actually very nice. At some point, you end up in a situation like this, and you might worry. Well, in principle, what we're saying is that we should not worry, because it might happen, and it does happen in this case, that can actually map, because of this duality, this theory into a free theory, which is fine, it's causal, everything works great. And so I guess the punchline is, whenever you have a Galilean theory which worries you, and maybe you have some superluminal propagation, you should not necessarily worry. See if you can map it into something nicer, as in this case. And you might tell me, well, this is a very specific case. Well, I mean, we don't know, right? Because, for example, here we have a quintic. And in some cases, when you're doing some calculations, the quintic term is actually the one dominating. So this map, the specific map between a quintic theory and a free theory, might not be as highly non-generic as it looks on this slide. This slide is simplified just to show you the power of this duality. And I think I wrap it up here. Yeah, so in order to conclude, I've talked to you about two things, about stable FRW cosmological solutions in bigravity, and we talked about the bound. And when we went to check that this bound is actually there and it's satisfied, we've done the calculation in many ways. One of these ways has been to do it in the decoupling limit of bigravity. And by studying the decoupling limit of bigravity, we have uncovered this duality between the Galilean pi and the Galilean rho. And this Galilean pi and rho turns out is very useful to study properties of highly non-trivial Galileans like the quintic and map them into simpler Galilean. Of course, I've shown you the free theory quintic map, which is the nicest one. The other maps might not just be as clear-cut as this one, but there is a map, and there wasn't a map before, and so we're very happy about it. Yeah.
If I write down a general quintic Galilean coupled to matter with some, say, pi t over m blank,
you're going to have to map the pi t as well.
Yes, well, what does the pi t turn into in free theory?
We haven't done that yet. But the hope is that, I mean, in principle, a simple pi t might look much different. I mean, if you're mapping it, but I mean, you gain so much on the non-source side of this map that it might still be worth doing the map. And so that's the hope.
Some 14 years ago, I published papers on bimetric gravity. And if you have two metrics like this, the second one is t nu phi, you find that you get two light cones that are not degenerate.
Mm-hmm.
And the speed of gravity or speed of light is greater than c.
Mm-hmm.
So you violate Lorentz equations. Potentially causality. There's no way around it. Just a simple calculation.
So, okay. So I would say that, I mean, because of this mapping, we think, you trust completely the free theory. You don't violate anything over there. So what we think is that there ought to be a way to show that whatever seems to be troublesome on the quintic theory side, because of this mapping, when you do the full calculation, so of course everything we're talking about is front velocity here. So when you do the full calculations, you consider loops in your calculations, you consider everything, and what naively looks like a superluminal propagation here, this slide here, as soon as you consider everything, you will end up with something which is actually has a front velocity, which is one, and is a causal theory. What we use this map for is to actually underline the fact that this calculation has its own limits, and its own limits are the fact that all the calculation was done at preview level over here. So what this map is telling us that whatever we have on this side ought to be true, and so whatever seems problematic on this side isn't actually problematic once you take into account the full calculation. As long as mapping between these two theory is concerned. Now, I don't know if I've completely answered the question, though.
The reason I published this as an alternative conflation, the variable speed of light cosmology.
Oh, I see.
And it looks like that.
Well, I'll look into that as if.
Papers, starting 1998. So you try, I don't see how you're going to avoid getting into problems with C. The whole point is to
I'll check if I can fit that in this discourse here. I will, and see if I can identify anything which looks like something that we have on. Well, not just that, but if I can identify something that looks anywhere close like to that Lagrangian, then I can probably fit what you have in this C and see if something is troublesome in this language as well. But it ought to be of that form, and if it is, then there ought to be a relation between these two approaches. Yes, and I can check that.
That's end it there. Thank you.